Hello and welcome to our University of Strathclyde podcast series, run out of the world-famous School of Education, right in the heart of the beautiful city of Glasgow in Scotland. We bring you a mix of meeting academic interviews, thought pieces, conversations and provocations on all things education, to give you a glimpse into our world-leading education research here at Strathclyde, and of course to stimulate your questions and thinking around the meaning, purpose and practice of education. In schools, in communities, and of course in all our lives. Today we are delighted to welcome Dr. Dario Banegas, lecturer in TESOL at the School of Education, to our Meet an Academic series. Dario is interviewed by Deputy Head of School and Reader in Education, Dr. Claire Cassidy.
Okay, Dario, so you're a lecturer in TESOL. Maybe you could explain to us a little bit about what TESOL is.
Yeah, sure. TESOL is teaching English to speakers of other languages, and it implies the teaching methodologies for the teaching of English in particular. People might think about or might be familiar with TESOL or ELT. TESOL is usually more American, I would say, and whereas ELT, English language teaching, is more UK driven, but the truth is that internationally speaking, TESOL or ELT as acronyms are used interchangeably.
So what led you to get into a career in research in English language teaching then?
When I was a kid, that was only a few years ago, I always had an interest in teaching. When I was a boy, I could see myself being a teacher. And I started studying English. I went to a language school in Argentina when I was a kid. And I liked it and I enjoyed learning English. So when I finished high school, I said to my parents, I would like to be a teacher of English. So I went to university in Argentina, graduated as a teacher of English. And it was only later, after a few years of practicing at the teaching of English as a foreign language, mainly with teenagers, that I decided to go for an MA and then later a PhD.
And do you think that you had a particular aptitude for language learning and that makes you a better language teacher?
I wouldn't say I had a particular aptitude, but because I enjoyed it, then I would spend more time studying or trying to read more in English, try to watch films in English. Imagine this is pre-internet times, so it wasn't that easy to find, say, authentic materials like videos, to learn the language, but I guess my own drive and my own motivation made me want to be a teacher and help other students achieve their, the goal of learning English to communicate mainly.
Yeah. Now you describe yourself though as a teacher researcher. So say a bit about that.
Yes. Even though now I'm in a university context, I still see myself as a teacher. In this case, I am preparing future teachers of English, mainly international students who want to be teachers of English when they go back to their home countries. So that's the teaching side of it. And through teacher associations in Latin America, I carry on working on projects that somehow, they're not necessarily research projects, but somehow give me the chance to be in touch with learners, to be in touch with teachers. That's the teaching side. The research side is, I usually research my very own practices. I am a fan of action research, a fan of practitioner inquiry. So I always tell myself that I don't need to see what other people are doing to investigate a particular issue. I always start off with my very own teaching, my very own practice. Of course, I do research with in different contexts and with other participants, but I always see myself as having, as wearing both hats, because all my research, or at least what I try to do, is I try to use my research to inform my teaching. So my teaching is research informed, but also as a reminder of that my research has to have a direct impact on practice, so that my research is practice driven, because that's what I want to do. I want to help teachers, I want to help students. So I've got to be aware of what happens in practice, and I've got to carry out my research and disseminate it in ways that are accessible for teachers and for the general public.
So what are you working on just now then?
I'm currently working on two projects. One is the School of Education. We are with my colleagues, Joanna McPaig and Alan Huang. We are working on trying to understand international students' notions and experiences with academic writing. And through action research, the idea is to support them and to help them improve their teaching, their learning skills when it comes to academic writing. And at the same time, we want to improve the way that we support them, so that we take more into consideration their biographies as learners, their knowledge of academic writing and academic conventions in both English and their own languages. And also we want to understand what happens in their own contexts. When we talk about international education and international students, and we promote that, then we've got to be extremely aware of what the students are bringing and how our own agenda and profile is aligned with their expectations and with their biographies as students. So that's one project that we are going to carry out this.
What findings have you got emerging at the moment?
Oh no, this is very at a very embryonic stage. We are actually surveying them next week. But so far, during induction, we did some activities with them, and the idea is that the notions they have are pretty different. They have different concepts of what an essay should look like. But that's because in different cultures, essays do not look exactly the same. And the other interesting thing is, even for us lecturers, when we write the instructions, the exam instructions or assignment instructions, we don't share the same understanding of an essay or structure.
The same understanding as lecturers, since the three of you are from different cultural backgrounds.
Yes, we do have, even though we have been educated in the UK, but then we are also aware of differences in terms of cultural representations of what good writing or academic writing is. For example, in Latin America, when we write essays, they are, first of all, but that's because of the language, sentences are extremely long, circumvoluted, and there's a lot of a strong poetic element in the writing. So it's not really that straightforward. And maybe you start reading and you say, well, where's your point? Make your point. And maybe there's no point. And that, of course, is very different from what you might expect here, where you've got, of course, a different concept, where your ideas have to be straightforward, your points got to be clearly laid out at the very beginning. So that's in crude terms, of course, that's one difference. The second project that I'm going to start working on is I just got awarded a research grant with the British Council. And the idea is to investigate, the aim is to investigate how future teachers are trained for bilingual education in three different countries. So I'll be working with teachers in Spain, Argentina, and Colombia. So that's, I was actually working on some bits the funder has asked me to revise just before this conversation, this talk interview.
So thinking about your whole body of work, because you've really published quite extensively in this area, if someone was to read only one piece of your work, what would that be and why?
Last year, I published this article on curriculum transformation and motivation in language education with a curriculum journal. And I think that article captures my interests with grassroots teachers, because the project is about supporting a group of teachers in Argentina, teachers of English, who started becoming aware of their demotivation to teach and the negative impact that their demotivation had on their learners. So we organized an action research project, no funding at all, with them, and we worked for one entire year, one school year, with it was 12 teachers and more than 700 students. And what happened was we opened up the curriculum. So we made the curriculum participatory. That meant the students started to suggest topics that they would like to cover in the English lesson, types of activities they would contribute with, flyers, songs, videos that then the teachers might want to use to prepare the lessons. And there was constant feedback from both the teachers and the students, and it was a lot about listening to the students, listening to their needs and wants, and truly placing them at the center. That was classroom-wise, but curriculum-wise, that meant localizing the curriculum, but localizing it in terms of the learners, in terms of the institution, in terms of the topics that you would not normally find in an international course book, for obvious reasons. So that allowed the teachers to exercise their agency as agents of change, as teachers who could not just deliver a curriculum developed by someone else, but who could create their own curriculum, because it was institutionally agreed, it was institutionally negotiated and discussed. Not necessarily, of course, they got approval from the head of school, etc. But the main thing here was that the transformative nature in which the curriculum was co-developed was with the students. So it was the students and the teachers working together to make the curriculum meaningful, relevant.
So transformative education seems to be a real drive then in the work that you do, both transformation of teachers and of the students. Would that be right?
That's my goal. Maybe I would say that perhaps I'd like to think about my work as transformative. Of course, that could be a stretch, because to measure transformation, you would need longitudinal studies and a really robust program that can track and trace transformation. But I think that it does contribute to making teachers aware of the power they have, how learners can be included in the picture in a sustainable way. And it doesn't require much, because my idea is that, you know, usually teachers might be seen always in a deficit position. It's not good enough what they're doing. They need to be doing something else. There's always something more they should be doing. And my approach is, let's start with what you are doing already, and let's make small changes, changes you can manage, changes you are in control of, and that you feel comfortable with, particularly because it is their work, and I've got to respect that, you know, under all circumstances. So it is, maybe it's not transformative, transformational, theoretically speaking, let's say, but it can transform, or it can change teachers' lives, even if it's in one context, in one school, with a group of learners. And that to me means a lot, because those teachers then start to assume control of their own teaching. So they become less course book dependent, less afraid of making changes, less afraid of seeking approval. And so they enjoy their autonomy, and they start to work together with other teachers. So their efforts are not individual, but collective. And the changes they make are self-initiated in most cases, but operationalized at an institutional level. So that makes them more sustainable, because it's not just one teacher making changes in one classroom, but it's a group of teachers making changes in one school. So that gives teachers more support to continue and to evaluate their own changes.
So that was something that you did without any funding. If I had £1 million to give you to do whichever research project you wanted to do, what would you spend it on?
Oh, so let's do it this way. If I don't get the funding from the Spencer Foundation, I can use your £1 million to run it. This project is about social justice in English language education. And my idea is to involve learners and student teachers to become materials developers. So they would be developing their own tasks, their own worksheets, and texts and videos that describe the lives of people who are usually marginalized or completely erased from international course books. So in one way, they will be localizing or decolonizing, or localizing the curriculum, but they will be completely working towards the creation of English language learning opportunities and approaches that are culturally sustaining, culturally relevant, and promote diversity and inclusion. So, for example, in the case, and that would be in Argentina, so I imagine students creating texts about native populations in Argentina, for example, something that, of course, you would never find in an international course book. Texts about people with different disabilities, families that do not conform to heteronormative expectations, a single mom, whatever, a child living with her parents, with her grandparents, sorry. So all these different ways in which all these different cultures or groups that are not usually mainstream, and that will give them a voice, the students, because then they will become actors in their own right. And through them, they will be creating opportunities for equality and localized pedagogies. So that I would spend my money on a project like that, that covers all kinds of schools, state schools, like rural schools, schools in difficult, like in backgrounds with difficult circumstances. So I would spend my money on that.
Well, I aim to buy a lottery ticket for tonight, did you? And I think the jackpot's £110 million. So okay. If I get the £110 million, you get your £1 million and you get to do your project regardless of the Spencer Foundation.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thanks. Yeah. Please don't forget to buy it.
So thanks very much, Didio. It's been really interesting speaking to you. I think we could listen to you for hours talking about the motivation for your
After
work.
20 minutes, I become dull and boring now.
Well, 20 minutes has been interesting. So thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much, Claire and Teams. Thank you.
Thank you for listening in to our Strathclyde Education Podcast Series. We'll be back soon with another episode.